Hello, I'm Andrew, and welcome to this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News for the 27th of March, 2024.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by the sight loss charity Beacons. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. Once you've enabled the Talking Newspapers skill, all you need to do is play Talking Newspapers and ask for the Black Country Talking News. Our Talking News service is also available via the free Wireless for the Blind app. It can be found on the Beacon Centre website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast via services such as Apple or Spotify, or as a free CD. Simply contact Beacon Centre on 01902 880 111. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Reading for you this week, we have myself, Andrew, Angela, Christine, Pete, Helen, Mary, Mina, Simon, and of course, not forgetting, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, including the Lifestyle newsletter with the nostalgia of the miners' strike. We have the latest local news for the Black Country. We have the quiz with Mina. All the latest football news, a Did You Know section from Flashback Roger. We hear from Mina, who has all the weather for the weekend. Local news to start with Christine. But first, Angela.
Health monitors have been installed in a number of libraries, community facilities and leisure centres across Wolverhampton. They give residents a chance to accurately measure their height, weight, BMI, body mass index, heart rate and blood pressure. No appointment is necessary and the checks are free, self-service and confidential, with results printed on a slip of paper for users to take away with them. The health monitors are available at Central, Bilston, Warstones and Wensfield Libraries, the Bob Jones Community Hub, WV Active Aldersley, WV Active Central and WV Active Bilston Bert Williams, and offer a valuable alternative to attending medical settings for low-level and non-clinical interventions. Staff at the various locations will not be able to provide clinical advice, but will be able to signpost residents to relevant information and advice. Where appropriate, blood pressure monitors are also available to loan to enable people to monitor their blood pressure for free at home. Councillor Jasbir Jaspal, Wolverhampton Council's Cabinet Member for Adults and Wellbeing, said, "We want to make it as easy as possible for our residents to take control of their own health and well-being, and this is one of the ways that we are giving them access to the tools they need to do just that. It is hoped these devices will encourage residents to prioritise getting their blood pressure checked, even if they have no apparent symptoms, as high blood pressure can lead to serious health issues like heart disease, stroke, kidney disease and vascular dementia if left unchecked." Councillor Bhupinder Gakhal, Cabinet Member for Visitor City, added, "Our libraries, leisure centres and community facilities offer a wide range of services and facilities to residents, and we are delighted to have been able to expand it further with the introduction of these health monitors. They are free to use, and we hope they will prove popular with and also useful to our customers." Up next, we hear from Helen, who, as usual, has our latest Beacon update.
A little bit of housekeeping to begin with. Due to the Easter bank holiday, there will be no Talking News next week. The next scheduled episode will be for the week commencing the 8th of April. Thank you so much for all your continued support. I hope you're enjoying the weekly editions just as much as we are.
Hi everyone, it's Helen from Beacon, back with your weekly update. And this week, I am starting with a Beacon supporter who is taking her fundraising to new heights. Let's all wish Julie the best of luck as she takes on the challenge of climbing Snowdon for a Sunrise Challenge in aid of a great cause. Julie's determination to support the Beacon Centre in honour of her dad, who's registered partially blind, is amazing. She will be starting her trek at, get this, 1 a.m. You can show your support by donating to her fundraising efforts to help people live well with sight loss. Every contribution makes a difference. If you'd like to donate, you can head to our Facebook page where you can find a link to her Just Giving online fundraising page. Now, next up, don't miss out on our free Living Well with Sight Loss course in partnership with RNIB. Join us to meet others in similar situations, boost your confidence and gain practical advice and resources. From understanding benefits to utilising technology and promoting well-being, our course covers it all. Sign up now to empower yourself and connect with a supportive community. To find out more details about our next course, call us on 01902 880111 or email inquiries@beaconvision.org. Now, next this week, a heartfelt thank you to the wonderful members of Bagridge Social Club. Thanks to their incredible generosity, we received £115 from a fantastic Christmas raffle and an additional £41.40 from their collection box. Their support means the world to us and will go a long way in ensuring that no one in our community has to face sight loss alone, helping us to create a brighter, more inclusive future for everyone. Now, last this week, get ready for a burst of colour and a whole lot of fun at the Beacon Centre's Family Fun Colour Run. Join us at Wolverhampton's East Park on Sunday, May the 12th for a 5K event like no other. Get covered head to toe in vibrant coloured powder as you make your way around the course with friends and family. Don't miss out on this unforgettable experience. Sign up now by heading to our website www.beaconvision.org/colour-run. That's it for this week. I'll be back again soon with another update. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot for that update, Helen. Up next, we have another block of local news.
The borough's libraries and archive services will continue to be managed by the current provider until November 2030, Dudley Council has confirmed. Charitable Social Enterprise GLL, Greenwich Leisure Limited, has been awarded the contract for the day-to-day management of the 13 libraries and Dudley Archives and Local History Service once again, following a competitive tender process. GLL, which has been running Dudley's libraries and archives since 2017, says it is committed to maintaining and building on the service. It is currently planning an official launch in the coming months of Briley Hill Library, following the £670,000 refurbishment, and later this year will launch the GLL Literary Foundation to support talented authors based near local libraries. Stephanie Roden, GLL Partnership Manager for Dudley Libraries and Archives, said, "We are delighted to have the opportunity to continue operating Dudley's libraries and archives in partnership with the Council for a further 6 years. We are really proud of what we have achieved to date, from operating throughout the pandemic in order to provide vital services to customers, to hosting Lenny Henry's first children's book launch and renovating Briley Hill Library, creating a much improved multifunctional space. We look forward to building on these successes in the future." Councillor Ian Bevan, Dudley Council's Cabinet Member responsible for libraries, said, "We look forward to working with GLL as they continue to provide such a key service to our residents."
And the demand for books in Wolverhampton may soon heat up too, as the University of Wolverhampton wants to increase its revenue by £100 million in the next 5 years by massively attracting thousands of international students who will pay higher fees than their domestic counterparts. After researching the international education market, the university has identified Latin America as the ideal place to recruit from. The ambitious plans were revealed by Vice-Chancellor Professor Ebrahim Adia at a Wolverhampton Business Forum meeting about the future of the city centre. He said, "International students will be transformational for Wolverhampton. In our five-year financial plan, we have factored in 5,000 new international students. We need to work with our partners to provide something special which will attract global students." He added, "There is a massive demand for Western-based university education in Latin America, with North America now too expensive. Now 5,000 students that will be worth to the university over £100 million. But to the city, these international students will have a transformational effect on the city centre." Professor Adia oversaw a similar transformation of the University of Lancashire in Preston before moving to Wolverhampton last year. He said, "What happens when there is a big increase in international students? There is a tipping point when the city really starts to take off, and I want that for Wolverhampton. The increase in international students is part of the change of direction for the university, which has seen arts and social sciences courses axed in favour of offering degrees more attractive to international students. Professor Adia wants to open a brand new School of Medicine in the city and has applied to be recognised as a research and development centre which benefit local hospitals." He said, "We are a multi-million pound business. We have 2,000 staff and 20,000 students who come into the city and spend their money. We are proud to be a driver of social mobility and will continue to be so. We are proud to increase the skills of the people of the Black Country." The Business Federation meeting saw major stakeholders, employers, developers and Wolverhampton Council agree city centre living will be the catalyst for economic and cultural success in the next two decades. Wensfield North Councillor Phil Bateman is ready to welcome Latin American students with open arms. He said, "We will give these South Americans a great Wolverhampton welcome, and they will need restaurants, shops, and whatever young people of their age and culture want, so a Latin quarter could spring up incredibly quickly. If we have to put on a few Ricky Martin nights in Wensfield to make them feel at home, then we shall do that." In 2021-22, there were 679,970 international students studying in the UK. They are a familiar sight in university cities and towns across the country and have been credited with keeping some higher education institutions open. Penn councillor Paul Singh is also excited about the city's ranks being swelled by Brazilians and Argentinians. He said, "Brazil are the gods of football. It is a way of life in Latin and South America. So as a fan of Wolves, there must be one out of 5,000 who could be the next superstar. They would certainly run out for the Wolves." He added, "But in all seriousness, this would be great for Wolverhampton and really make us an even better global city. If there is a big community of anyone, the benefits are usually clear to see."
Now it's time to test your knowledge, as we have the quiz questions for this edition brought to us by Mina.
Hello and welcome to this week's flashback quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' Did You Know feature. But for now, these are your questions. Here we go. Question 1. Do identical twins have the same fingerprints? Question 2. What odd thing do they say about water? Question 3. How many letters are there in the word for the fear of long words? Question 4. What was the name of the Roman poet who first used this long word? Question 5. In a recent study, what colour kit is worn by successful football teams? And finally, question 6. What was being built when some stars were born? I will be back with you later in the show to give you all your answers. But for now, best of luck.
Cheers for those, Mina. Up now is another Beacon update. Welcome to Beacon's Lifestyle Newsletter, April 2024. As I'm sure you're aware, Beacon, as all organisations, have been impacted by the planned increase to national living wage from the 1st of April 2024. At 9.8%, this represents a significant impact to the cost of delivering our activities. Beacon continues to subsidise as many of our services as possible, and we actively approach funders and individuals to support our activities. However, we inevitably have to be able to increase the cost of our services from the 1st of April 2024. Throughout this newsletter, you will find new prices associated with each activity. We have based this increase on the rise in staff costs alone and have not included any increasing operating costs, which we are doing all we can to
mitigate.
We continue to explore ways to support the subsidy of the provisions and support individuals to ensure that they receive all eligible finance support. Please note, if you're unable to attend an activity for any reason, we will need 48 hours notice to avoid a cancellation charge. And if you wish to cancel a service in full, it is a chargeable notice period of 14 days. Please telephone 01902 880 111 if you need to cancel your visit.
Monthly sessions. A little bit of housekeeping to begin with. A few reminders that we will no longer be invoicing for any sports, social or community activities. We now have a card machine, float and online payment system to allow you all to pay when you book on or attend an activity. Any non-attendance without prior cancellation will be charged. Please ensure you have cash or a card available to pay for activities when you book or arrive at an activity. All transport costs will still be invoiced.
We start off this month with a drop-in event in the Residence Lounge at the Beacon Centre on Tuesday the 2nd of April between 10am and 11am. It's a chance to come along and find out more about all this month's forthcoming activities. Mary will also be available to help you book onto any of the activities that you may be interested in. On Wednesday the 3rd of April, it's Mary's movement class, a seated or standing class working the whole body with cardio, weights and strength to your ability. It's fun and friendly with your music choice. 10:30 to 11:30am, based in the gym at the Beacon. The class cost is £5. Also this month, on Thursday the 4th of April, there's a chance to talk, laugh and chat over tea, coffee and biscuits, as it's the book club meeting in the Residence Lounge at the Beacon Centre, Sedgley, from the new start time of 10:30am until 12pm, and at a cost of £2.50. Monday the 8th of April, we shall be running another new circuit class at Beacon Gym. The session will run from 11am to 12pm and will allow for use of all gym equipment with a fun circuit included. Get set for an enjoyable, loud and sweaty gym session. The cost is £5 per person. Wednesday the 10th and Monday the 22nd of April, swimming at Burt Williams Centre, Bilston, WV14-0EF, 10:45 to 11:45 a.m. We have a private lane just for Beacon users. All abilities are welcome. The activity cost is £6.50. The minibus costs £5.50. It departs at 10:15 a.m. and returns at 1 p.m. Lockers are £1 or a trolley token. Friday the 12th of April, walking around the paths, trails and tracks at Saltwells Nature Reserve. This walk is on pavements, grass, hills and uneven surfaces and should take approximately 2 to 3 hours. The activity cost is £2.50. The minibus costs £5.50, leaving the Beacon at 10:30 a.m. and returning at approximately 2:30 to 3 p.m. If you're meeting us there, please head to the Saltwells Inn, Coppice Lane, Quarry Bank, DY20AP. Free car parking is available, weather permitting. Monday the 15th and the 29th of April, Tandem is back. Tandem bike ride at Bobbington Airport and the surrounding country roads, DY7, 5DY. 10:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Bikes are provided and there will be experienced lead riders present to support you. Trip cost is £3.50, minibus costs £7.70, departing at 10 a.m. and returning at 1:30 p.m. to the Beacon. Weather permitting. Thursday the 18th of April, we have another pop-up cinema event in the Residence Lounge at the Beacon Centre for the Blind. The activity cost is £5 with popcorn, chocolate and sweets provided. Transport to and from the centre is also available.
This month's film is Eddie the Eagle.
Friday the 19th of April, 10-pin bowling at Castlegate Studley, DY1 4TA, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. All abilities are welcome, with a friendly and fun atmosphere for social bowling. Trip cost is £2.50. Activity cost is £6.50 for 2 games, paying at the bowling alley on the day. Minibus costs £5.50, departs at 10:30 a.m. and returns at 2 p.m, invoiced by Beacon. Friday the 26th of April, walking round West Park, Wolverhampton, WV1 4SQ. From 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. for a leisurely walk and 12 till 1 to catch up in the cafe. Take it at your own pace and complete your own chosen distance on a paved flat route. We'll meet at the Connaught Road gate entrance. The activity cost is £2.50, minibus costs £5.50 and departs at 10:30 a.m, returning at 1:30 p.m, invoiced by Beacon. Volunteer guides are available, weather permitting. All activities must be booked in advance with Mary by calling 01902 880111.
What's on this month?
Thursday the 11th of April, archery at the Wolf Mountain Centre, Paget Road, Wolverhampton, WV6ODU, from 12 till 1. The cost is £14.40 and you will need to give Mary a £5 deposit to secure your place by the 2nd of April. The rest of the cost is paid on the day at the centre. There is a £2.50 Beacon cost to the activity also, and the minibus costs £5.50, departs at 11 a.m. and returns at 2 p.m. Free car parking if you're meeting us there, limited spaces. Wednesday the 17th of April, there's a meal out at the Newbridge Pub, Tettenhall Road, Wolverhampton, WV6OJU. This is from 12 o'clock onwards. The cost of the activity is £2.50. Minibus costs £5.50 and departs at 11:30 a.m. to return at 3 p.m. Tuesday the 30th of April, Bridge North Garden Centre trip. Bridge North Road, Shipley, Wolverhampton, WV67EJ. The cost of the activity is £2.50 and the minibus costs £5.50. This will depart at 10 a.m. and return at 3 p.m. Full day at the centre where you can look around independently. Coming soon, Tuesday the 14th of May, day at Dudley Zoo, including a 60-minute private educational tactile tour, limited spaces. Tuesday the 18th of June, private tour at Cosford, designed specifically for visually impaired people, the National Cold War exhibit, limited spaces. Tuesday the 25th of June, our author is back for a question and answer session.
VIP group. We are a group of working age people and or people who live independently with sight loss that meet once a month for a social gathering. We're a friendly bunch that likes to try new activities, build friendships and encourage others to live life to the full. Now then, how would you like to add a little pep to your step? Well, on Wednesday the 24th of April, we've got a whole lot of fun as we introduce an evening of barn and folk dance at the Lighthouse Restaurant at the Beacon Centre. Led by a qualified instructor, there will be something for everyone, from dancing to singing or just coming along and enjoying the night. The activity is £3.50 starting at 6 p.m. and finishing at around 8 p.m. during which time the bar will also be open. We hope to see you there.
Are you struggling with the weather, with the discomfort of bright light or glare, perhaps finding it a little more difficult to read, make a call, tell the time, or do those daily tasks? Well, Beacon may be able to help. With our team of sightless advisors, you could make an appointment to try out some low vision equipment, such as a video magnifier, some fit over filter glasses, or a fully vocalized and voice controlled mobile phone. It might be something that just makes life a little bit easier. Even if you are not experiencing sight loss yourself, perhaps you are a carer and or have a family member or friend that is struggling. So please call Beacon on 01902 880 111 and ask to speak with our team of sight loss advisors. That number again, 01902 880 111.
Beacon Gym Page. As you may be aware, Rob is leaving us at the end of March after working with Beacon for 2 years. We've had some real success stories from people using the gym and lots of new equipment that Rob has very kindly helped and supported us with. From the 1st of April, I, Mary, will be the new gym instructor and will be starting this role next week. I will book in the one-on-one sessions with individuals throughout the week, Monday to Friday, while continuing to run all the regular activities in the newsletter. During April, I will be contacting all current members, both who come in supervised and unsupervised. I'm sure you'll be really happy for my move and support me, lovely people. Thank you again to Rob for everything he's helped with over the last couple of years. We really do appreciate it. The cost from the gym from the 1st of April 2024 is as follows. If you are coming in unsupervised, it is £5 an hour. If you are coming in unsupervised and want to pay monthly, it's £22 an hour. If you require supervision, it's £11 per hour or £44 per month. See you soon, guys. This month's Meet the Staff. It is all about Katie Johns. She started working for Beacon Centre in January of this year. She is a community support intern. Her job is to help set up hubs and activities for the Beacon Centre and try to build a bigger and stronger community for visually impaired individuals of all ages. She is stationed downstairs in the low vision office, so feel free to go and say hello, as she'd love to meet as many people as possible, hear your ideas about getting out into the community, socialising and making new friends. Katie is 24 and she is visually impaired. She loves coming to work and helping others that are in a similar situation to her. She loves to create days out and activities that are inclusive for all visually impaired people. In her spare time, she enjoys being creative, doing embroidery, drawing,
along with reading true crime books. She's very noticeable with her bright green and blue hair, piercings, tattoos, and low voice. Feel free to contact Katie on 01902 880 111 or kjohns, J-O-H-N-S, at beaconvision.org. She'd love to hear from you.
The miners' strike 40 years on. The day relations between the police and miners changed forever. The baking sunshine glistens in the vast man-made lake, while residents of the vast new housing estates walk their dogs. Giant wind turbines tower above the university campus in the distance, framed by the glass and steel frontages of the neighbouring technology companies, and then, jarring incongruously with the scene of serene modernity, is a scruffy-looking footbridge covered in graffiti. Scargill number one, it says in one place, Tories out in another. This is where the Battle of Orgreave took place. The disorder, which saw mounted police clash with hundreds of pickets, looked more akin to a skirmish during the Norman Conquest than a modern-day industrial dispute. At least 123 people were injured, although the NUM claimed the figure was higher. Journalist Alastair Stewart described the disorder as a defining and ghastly moment that changed forever the conduct of industrial relations and how this country functions as an economy and as a democracy. Historian and former Labour MP Tristram Hunt described it as almost medieval in its choreography. At various stages, a siege, a battle, a chase, a rout, and finally a brutal example of legalised state violence. The left-leaning barrister Michael Mansfield said it was the worst example of a mass frame-up in this country this century. For Scargill, this was meant to be a reenactment of Saltley Gate. His shutdown of the Birmingham gasworks had forced Ted Heath's government into total capitulation and turned him into the most prominent trade union leader in the country. Now he saw the same to do the same with Margaret Thatcher. Scargill regarded the coking works at the former Orgreave Colliery, just outside Rotherham, as of crucial strategic importance in his battle with the government. The plant turned coal into coke for use in steel production, and in the early months of the strike, the NUM agreed to limited movement of coal to prevent damage to steel furnaces. However, Scargill and many senior figures in the NUM became convinced that the National Coal Board was abusing this agreement and exceeding its quotas. An informal pact known as the Triple Alliance had existed between the NUM and the unions in the steel and rail industries, as Scargill asked steel workers not to handle deliveries of coal. But Bill Serres, leader of the Iron and Steel Trades Confederation, ISTC, defied Scargill's call, saying that it would put rolling mills and billet forges out of action, putting his members at risk of job losses. Serres instructed his members to handle any fuel they were presented with. Scargill's policy of targeting the steel industry was also met with some opposition within his own ranks. The steel industry was a major customer of the National Coal Board, and Scargill's deputy, Mick McGarhy, was concerned that shutting down parts of the steel industry would simply lead to a decline in demand for coal. McGarhy was particularly concerned about the Ravenscraig steelworks in Scotland, which he had campaigned to save. He knew that just a single day's stoppage could sound the death knell for Ravenscraig. Tensions were running high in Yorkshire following the death of Joe Green, a picket who was fatally struck by a trailer while trying to stop deliveries to Ferrybridge Power Station. 2 days after Green's death, Scargill addressed a packed rally at nearby Wakefield, where he made an impassioned plea to close Orgreave. The following day, Scargill deployed 5,000 pickets from across the UK with the aim of closing the plant down. Determined there would be no repeat of Saltley Gate, South Yorkshire Police drafted in 6,000 officers from 18 different forces, and they were issued with full riot gear for the first time in the 12-week-old dispute. Among them were 42 mounted officers, and dog units were also called in. The battle lines were drawn.
On the morning of June 18, 1984, pickets began to gather at about 8 o'clock in an effort to stop the convoy of British Steel coke lorries from entering the depot. Hundreds of officers lined the road to ensure their safe passage, and a nervous standoff took place. According to Tristram Hunt, a few missiles and bricks were thrown, and Assistant Chief Constable Tony Clement, the commander on the ground, responded by sending in the mounted police. It was a serious overreaction, and the miners' mood quickly turned violent, said Hunt. The pickets countered with a second push. Clement ordered another mounted advance and demanded that the pickets disperse. They refused, and Clement ordered a third advance, backed up by baton-wielding police in riot gear. Mayhem followed, and any semblance of order quickly disappeared. Accounts vary widely, but it is broadly accepted that bricks were thrown at police, and some responded by beating unarmed pickets with their truncheons. The image of bloodied picket Russell Broomhead, allegedly beaten about the head by a police truncheon, became a potent symbol of the battle. Striking miners claimed they were forced to flee across a live railway line to escape the advance of mounted officers. The following day's newspapers were filled with pictures of injured pickets, police, and pitched battles. It was the day that changed the relationship between the police and mining communities for a generation. PC Bob Moon, on secondment from West Midlands Police on the day of the disorder, was one of the officers who were injured. "I caught a brick on my ankle which cracked it," he recalls. "I got a very nice letter from the Chief Constable of Yorkshire Police." Bob blames political activists for stirring up divisions. He and his fellow officers had been billeted to an RAF base, where they lived in three-bedroom semi-detached houses previously used by forces families. He recalls the first time he and his colleagues tried the village pub. "Four of us went down in the village to a quiet-looking pub," he recalls. "We were dressed in jeans and sweatshirts and just looking for a quiet couple of hours away from the mindset of the strike. I went to the bar and asked for four pints. The barman looked me in the eye and said nothing. I asked again and again, but he kept staring at me and saying nothing. I wondered whether I'd got two heads or maybe I'd said something to offend him. Again, I asked for four pints and this time added, 'Look, we just want a quiet pint, okay?' By then, the pub had fallen silent and I was aware all the customers were looking at me. I glanced at the boys who were sitting at a table by the door. We always sat by the door to give ourselves room to fight and drag our opponents outside and to see who came in. I turned back to the barman and raised my eyebrows without saying a word. Very quietly, he asked, 'Are you police?' We never hid what we did, so I said, 'Yes.' He asked, 'Are you here because of the strike?' I told him, 'We wouldn't be here on beeping holiday, would we?' He laughed and started pouring the beer. He explained the pub had been visited numerous times by men dressed like us but were political activists and they had upset the locals. I asked him what he meant by upset. He shrugged and said most of them now carried weapons. I took the tray of beer over to the boys and a young girl about 17 came over and sat down at the only spare chair at the table. Her father was a retired miner and she told us he had visited the miners' social club the previous week and been beaten up when he left. She had tears in her eyes. While she was speaking, the whole pub was quiet. Everyone seemed to be watching us and we were watching them out of the corner of our eyes. I was waiting for a sign to indicate trouble, but I didn't see one. What I saw was a group of people who wanted to talk, but couldn't. People who were scared. The village was a working village, a place where some people had refused to strike, and one of the places visited by activists. The people had been intimidated, threatened, and some of them had been attacked. They were honest, peaceful people, and all of the trouble had come as a shock. They didn't want it, they hadn't invited it, and didn't understand the violence. To them, the activists were bad enough, but then there were armies of police from other parts of the country. Their whole world had been turned upside down.
For Lyndon Whitehouse, there was little time to frequent the local hostelries. We paraded at Tipton at 2 a.m. and travelled to South Yorkshire on a daily basis, he says. We used to get back around 7 p.m. and were back on duty at 2. On one occasion, I suffered an ankle injury and was taken to Rotherham General Hospital, which was packed with police and miners. Kevin Horn, a 36-year-old striking Yorkshire miner at the time, recalls events somewhat differently. We parked up in an estate and walked down past the old spoil tip, he says. We were halfway down when the police came into sight in a field down at the bottom, and we stopped and just gasped. My mate said to me, "It's like an army," because there were 5,000 police officers marching in blocks. And these weren't on the front line, they were in reserve with horses and dogs. It was frightening. Like many pickets that day, he believes they were set up by police officers who were intent on a ruck. There were coaches from South Wales, Scotland and Durham, and the police were waving them in. This had never happened before. There were signposts saying, "This way to Orgreave." They took us there to give us a good hiding, and that's exactly what they did. They wanted to break the miners. Assistant Chief Constable Tony Clement denied that there was any intention to attack the miners, but made clear that the police were ready for violence. "If it was going to be a pitched battle, it was going to be on my terms," he said. Peter Wright, the Chief Constable at the time, insisted the response was proportionate. The number of police officers there has been increased as the number of pickets increased, and any police reaction was something the minor pickets were doing, he said on the day of the drama. Skirmishes continued throughout the weeks that followed, and on May 30th, Scargill himself was famously arrested. He was fined £250 for causing willful obstruction. After the trials of the 95 pickets collapsed, 39 sued South Yorkshire Police for assault, false arrest and malicious prosecution. The force eventually settled out of court, paying £425,000 in compensation in 1991, but it never admitted liability. In 2012, South Yorkshire Police referred itself to the Independent Police Complaints Commission following allegations in a BBC documentary that some officers might have colluded in writing court statements. But in 2015, the IPCC concluded there was no direct evidence of senior officers within the force instructing colleagues to commit perjury and announced it would not hold a new investigation into claims police used excessive force. Today, few people in Orgreave talk about the battle. The coking plant closed in 1990 and the site was redeveloped by the Harworth Group, the former property arm of the National Coal Board, which reinvented itself as a developer specialising in brownfield reclamation. Now rebranded as Waverley, the area has been gentrified and is largely occupied by young professionals, and you detect little nostalgia for the days of coal. A man sitting on a bench overlooking the lake tells how the area has changed since his youth. "It's a lot better. It was a messy area around here. It's a lovely environment here now. People appreciate it."
Up next, it's trivia time, brought to us by Flashback Roger and his Did You Know feature. Take it away, Roger.
Hello again, everyone. Well, this week's Sprinkle of Oddities are odder than ever, in my opinion. See what you think. So, did you know that identical twins don't have the same fingerprints? So you can't blame your crimes on your twin after all. This is because environmental factors during development in the womb, such as umbilical cord length, the fetus position in the womb, and the rate of finger growth, all impact on your fingerprint. And well, wouldn't you just know it, I say now that water might not actually be wet. This is because most scientists define wetness as a liquid's ability to maintain contact with a solid surface. For as it runs off those, it suggests that water itself is not wet. But it can of course make other objects wet. And the fear of long words is called hippopotomonstrosesquiptaliphobia. The 36-letter word was first used by the Roman poet Horace in the 1st century BCE to criticise those writers with an unreasonable penchant for long words. It was an American poet who was possibly afraid of their own surname who coined the term, if that makes any sense. And football teams wearing red kits play better. The colour of your clothes can affect how you're perceived by others and change how you feel. A review of football matches in the past 55 years, for example, showed that teams wearing a red kit consistently played better in home matches than teams in any other colour. And while we're on the subject of football, football players spit so much because exercise increases the amount of protein in your saliva. When you exercise, the amount of protein secreted into the saliva increases. A protein mucus named MUC5B makes your saliva thicker when you're exercising, which makes it more difficult to swallow, so we spit more. It may occur during exercise because we breathe through our mouths more, and MUC5B activates to stop your mouth from drying out too much. When you gaze into the night sky, you see stars as they were 4,000 years ago with the naked eye. Without a telescope, all the stars we can see lie within about 4,000 light years of us. That means you're seeing stars as they were 4,000 years ago, around when the pyramids were being built in Egypt. So, what do you think about that lot then? Strange or what? Certainly unusual, if nothing else to my mind. Any road up, it's back to earth for me. I'll fill my kettle with water, which isn't wet now we're told, and make me a brew to have with my Kit Kat. So till next time then, I'll sign off and say Happy Easter to everyone. See you next time. Bye for now. Ta-ra a bit. Ta-ra.
Up now we have to hear what the weather has in store for us. Brought to us, come rain or shine, by our own Sunny Mina.
The weather for this week ahead is forecast to remain unsettled with plenty of showers, but with a moderate breeze continuing from the south, we will see temperatures staying relatively mild at 13 degrees. With plenty of sunny spells to accompany the showers, UV levels will fluctuate between low and medium. The sunrise and sunset times are set to change from Sunday 31st of March, as don't forget the clocks spring forward an hour, which unfortunately means we will lose an hour in bed on Sunday. But we do start to enjoy more sunlight in the evenings as we hopefully venture into some brighter months ahead. So from Sunday, the sunrise and sunset times are 6:35 a.m. for the sunrise and 7:50 p.m. for the sunset. Friday 29th of March is forecast to have a dry and rather sunny start to the day, with strong chance of showers breaking through in the afternoon. With a moderate breeze, temperatures are forecast to be mild at around 12 degrees. Moving on, and a mixture of sunshine and showers looks set to continue into the weekend, with both Saturday and Sunday looking unsettled. With the winds continuing to drive in from the south, a breezy weekend also means temperatures will remain mild at 13 degrees, with Saturday looking like it will provide the more favourite weather over Easter. On to next week, where the spell of wet weather will, of course, be welcoming in the new month. It is forecast for April showers to be right on cue from Monday 1st of April and continuing right through to Wednesday 3rd of April. With light winds coming in from the east, temperatures may not be as mild but should remain in double digits all week, with highs of 10 to 12 degrees. By the end of the week, we will begin to see the return of the moderate breeze, so there is every chance that Thursday may actually resemble something closer to spring, with a lovely, dry, sunny day. As always, wishing you all a peaceful, pleasant and happy holidays. Do take care and enjoy the weather.
Thanks for that weather update, Mina. Up now, we have a special edition of this week's sports feature.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello again, folks. It's Liz from East Kilbride. Rose Riley, you may not know the name, but you know she's been overlooked too long, the lost superstar of Scottish women's football. Born in 1955 near Kilmarnock, and at the age of 7, she began playing with local boys at the club called Stourton United. She adored football. She was given a doll for her Christmas and swapped it for a football. Played keepy-uppy on the road coming back from the school. And then at the playground in her school, she would go into the boys' playground, play football. And when the head teacher found out about this, she got the belt. But she didn't care because she wanted to play football. Now, she was able to play for this boys' team, but the coach, who knew she was a great wee player, took her aside and said, "Well, you can play for us as long as you have a short back and sides haircut, and you'll just need to call yourself Ross." So that's what she did. Her mother nearly killed the barber when he found out about the haircut, but Rose did not care. She was playing one Saturday morning for this wee boys' team, and a scout from the great Glasgow Celtic was on the sidelines, watched the play going on the pitch. And the scout turned to the coach of the wee team and said, "Well, we'll want to sign that wee number 7. Great wee player." And the coach said, "That number 7's a wee lassie." Now, what was going to happen to this wee lassie? Well, in Scotland at that time, not very much. The SFA, the Scottish Football Association, were completely against girls' football, women's football, professional football for women. It was absolutely a non-starter. Some of the women kept trying to play. They were never given any facilities at all, never allowed to share buildings, so they would get changed behind trees and in the backs of cars. It was awful. And Rose decided she really, really was a good enough footballer to make it as a professional. Her case was taken up by Jerry Hassan, who was a reporter in Scotland, and he pointed out to her that if she wanted to go abroad, she would find the world of women's football and professional football was well established. So at the age of 17, she and her pal Edna came home one day, packed their suitcases and told their parents that they were going to go to France in the first instance, and if that didn't work, they were going to go on to Italy. As Rose says in her wonderfully vivid account, I had only ever eaten spaghetti hoops, and now I was talking about going to Italy. They set off aged 17. She played for 6 months in Reims in the French League, and then she moved to AC Milan for 4 years. Rose found herself among the elite of European women footballers, and she thrived. She won championship titles in both Italy and France, would play in the French League on a Saturday, and then flew over to play another game on the Sunday. This fame did not go to her head. She remained the very much the same gal, but on the other hand, she did really embrace Italy. "I started drinking espresso coffee," she wrote. "I was being wined and dined all over Italy. Previously, the only place I'd been to was the Chippy in Stourton." This life, this success, brought Rose to the notice of the Italian football authorities, because they could see she was definitely their best player. Now, they wanted their best player to be playing for the Italian national side. Rose at that point was still a British citizen. There was an international coming up. The authorities in Italy had a plan to get her through the naturalisation system a bit faster. "I still hadn't been naturalised as Italian," says Rose. "So the president said, 'How do you fancy marrying some old guy in a nursing home?' 'God,' I said, 'I'm from a God-fearing family. My mother would have killed me.'" So she had to wait it out till the paperwork came through. And indeed it did. In 1983, she was voted the world's best female footballer. And in 1984, she was selected for the Italian women's national team, was voted the best player in the Italian team, which won the Mundialito in 1984. And here's the big cruncher here. That was the early version of the Women's World Cup. So really, Scotland does have a World Cup winner in the persona of Rose Riley. She continued a long and amazingly successful career abroad, and she was still playing well into her 30s. And in fact, by the age of 40, she had retired. She was living in Sicily and running a sports shop, but still playing football and kept playing in the local police seven-a-side team. And that's where matters take a romantic twist, because while playing for the local police team in Sicily, she tore a calf muscle and was referred to a local doctor, originally from Argentina, who specialised in sports injuries. And his name was Peralta, and that was the man who became Rose Riley's husband. So she's now Rose Riley Peralta. Finally retiring, and finally with a happy family life, Rose returned to Stourton. Really not very much known, though known in the local area as that great footballer. She was our great footballer. And recognition has come very gradually to Rose Riley. She's a patron and a very active supporter of the Walking Football Association. She has an honorary degree from Caledonian University in Glasgow. And then, most recently, in her own wee town of Stourton in Ayrshire, the sports centre was renamed the Rose Riley Sports Centre as a tribute to our local World Cup winner, our town's footballing superstar. How does Rose react to the sports centre being named after her? Here's what she says. "I gave away all my medals and trophies during my playing career, but having my local sports centre named after me is my legacy. I'm so proud for my wee village, and I'm so proud of this honour. So I think the reason we should look at Rose Riley, and she thoroughly deserves her place now in the Scottish Football Hall of Fame, is that she stuck to her beliefs that sport was important and valuable for women. She stuck to her view that if she couldn't play it properly in Scotland, she would follow her dreams, and they took her to a life beyond her wildest imaginings in France and in Italy, hailed as an international superstar. But then coming back to Scotland and hopefully seeing the attitudes changed, where Scotland has a vibrant national team, where women's football, which has been knocked back generation after generation, is now surely well established in sport in general and well loved by many men and women. And that's why I chose to give you the life, the personality and the wonderful talent of Scotland's World Cup winner, our footballer, Rose Riley.
DNF Soundings.
Now, here come the quiz
answers,
and they're brought to us by Mina.
Hello, and here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Feeling confident? How will you score? Let's see. Question 1. Do identical twins have the same fingerprints? And the answer here is, no, they don't. Question 2. What odd thing do they say about water? Answer, by definition, it's not wet. Question 3. How many letters are in the word for the fear of long words? And the answer, it's 36 letters long. Question 4. What was the name of the Roman poet who first used this long word? It was Horace. Question 5. In a recent study, what colour kit is worn by successful football teams? And the answer here, of course, it's red. And finally, question 6. What was being built when some stars were born? And the answer, the pyramids in Egypt. Did you get them all right? If not, not to worry, as I will be back next week to test you all once again. Bye for now.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!